If you've ever watched a football game, so far you can still hold it up on a sign. I don't know how long that's going to last. Watch a basketball game, amidst all the streamers behind the backboard, you'll see somebody hold up a sign that says John 3:16, which says that God loved the world so much that he gave his only son, that whoever would trust in him, cling to him, rely upon him fully, would never perish, but have everlasting what? Life. But it didn't say everlasting bios. I looked at a picture of myself the other day, back when, well, never mind, we don't want to know how far I've degenerated, but you know what? These bodies are falling apart as we speak. If you're in your 20s, you don't get it yet, trust me, you're gonna fall apart just like the rest of us. You just got a longer time to wait for it to happen. If he'd have said, I've come so that people who trust in me would have everlasting bios, that would be kind of be bad news. Can you even imagine? I remember when my grandmother's 98 years old and she finally died. And I remember Gwen when she was 94 years old and she finally died. They were so glad to go. They were so glad to be with Jesus. Who wants to hang out in this stinking body any longer than I have to? No, he said, everlasting Zoe. Have life, Zoe. Life on every plane of existence that lasts forever. So, John says the source, the wellspring of real, honest-to-goodness life. By the way, he could have said that not only about Zoe, he could have said it about bios as well. If Jesus made everything, if it was all life started at the impulse of his creation, then it could also be said that, you know, he was the source of bios as well as Zoe. That life, John says, was the light of humans, everyone. Couple other words that John uses a lot, but I want you to notice the specificity. Oh, I love that word. It just makes me sound smart. It sounds smart. Specificity, you know, sounds really great if you use it with a Julie Andrews accent. Specificity, that's the second Sunday in a row I talked about Julie Andrews. You guys are going to think I've got some fantasy problems, but I honest to goodness, I really don't. She was pretty cute when she was younger, though. Specificity, that particular life that finds its source in Jesus, meaning that no other kind of life, just the life that comes from him, that life was the light of humans. Not a light for humans, the light, very specific. Not a light among others, and that's the primary difference between what the Bible teaches about Jesus and almost every other world religion, what it says about Jesus. He wasn't one of many. He made that bold statement I read to you back in John 14. He says, I'm the way to God. Nobody comes to him except through me. That is so arrogant, if it's not true, or delusional. But if it's true, it changes everything, because he said anybody that wants to can come. No restrictions. He just said, I'm the door. You don't get in if you don't come through me, but you're welcome to come. You're welcome not to come. You just won't like the alternative. He was the light of man. This is another word that John uses. It's obviously figurative. I'll give you the Greek word if you're interested. It's the word phos, P-H-O-S, light. It's the word we get phosphorescent from, which means self-generating of light. Phos. But when it's used figuratively, as it is here, it speaks of moral and spiritual, the moral and spiritual compass, or the true north that a compass points to. It speaks of spiritual and moral illumination, ultimately that which draws humans to the divine. So the life that comes from Jesus and only comes from him is the moral and spiritual compass and illumination for every human. I have to say something here, and I'm not a philosopher either. But this statement right here, and many others in the Bible, is the exact opposite of relativism. And relativism is like the sacred cow of our culture these days. Relativism is the belief that in ethics, it's a theory, that in cultural matters and ethics and values, that all judgments and values are relative to the circumstance of the person. Like my truth is different than your truth. And relativism is really, really popular. The problem is the Bible said, you know, that's just not going to wash with God, because here's the truth. There's one light. There's one truth. It's wrapped up and embodied in the person of Jesus.
Well, I just don't think it's fair that you could just tell me that I'm wrong.
Well, that's why I just like to read what Jesus says, because then you can take it up with him. The exact opposite of relativism, that life is the light of humans. And verse 5, and the light, that light, specific article, present tense, shines in the darkness. Anybody have an Amplified Bible? Jack, do you have yours with you? Okay. The Amplified Bible, I believe, and I don't have mine with me either, but I believe that it gives you the fatness of the Greek word, because the Greek phrase says that light shines. The verb says shines continuously without interruption. And it's still shining. Present tense. That light still shines in the darkness. Poets and artists and playwrights and songwriters for millennia have been using the figurative ideas of light as the good and, you know, pure, and darkness as the icky, bad, nasty, naughty. This word darkness is a distinct Greek word. It's the word skotia, S-K-O-T-I-A, if you want to look it up. It means, and once again, figuratively, it speaks of moral and spiritual condition which is opposed to God's rule. In Ephesians 5, if you can remember months ago when we studied Ephesians 5, it says once, speaking to believers, once you were darkness, but now you're light in the Lord. So live like children of light, not like children of darkness. The Bible says that we have been brought out of the kingdom of darkness where we were trapped. We met Jesus. We've been brought out of the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of light. Perfect contrast. The two are mutually exclusive. Interesting here that it says that of the two, light is stronger. I remember somebody did an experiment one time, and it was either the Detroit Silver Dome or the Houston Astrodome. I'm not sure which one. One of those big dome stadiums. Turned out all the lights, blocked off any outward source of light, and a guy went down and stood in the middle of the field and lit a match and held the match up above his head. And every seat and every corner of that arena, you could see that tiny little match. How much light does it take to show up in the darkness? Well, all the darkness there is cannot extinguish even a tiny light. I think that's an important thing to keep in mind when you live in a dark place, to just glow in the darkness. You may not think people notice. You can be obnoxious about it, or you can just try to glow in the darkness, but people do notice. Here's the verdict, it says in John 3:19, which we'll get to in a month or so. Here's the verdict. Light has come into the world. The problem is people love darkness instead of light. I know a number of people, I'm convinced that they came out of the kingdom of darkness into light when they asked Jesus into their lives. I don't understand this mechanism, but I know people, people I love who, looking back over the fence into the kingdom of darkness, have thought, you know, it's pretty boring here in the kingdom of light. There are better parties, more sex, more fun back in the kingdom of darkness. I think I'll go back there. I don't understand the I understand because I've watched people do it. The fact that the Bible tells us in Ephesians that we used to be darkness and now we're light and that we should live that way tells me that I do have a choice how I can live. God brings me into his kingdom, but he doesn't nail me down and say, you have to stay there. I can walk out if I want to. I don't know why you'd want to. The light is shining still, continuously, without interruption, in the darkness. And the darkness has never been able to absorb it. Of all of the English words for this Greek word, probably absorb is better than understood. Although, to be fair, if you look it up in a Greek dictionary, it just speaks of laying hold of something in order to comprehend it, or trying to extinguish something. Most of the Greek scholars agree that if you're going to pick one of those definitions, the best one is to pick is the word overpower or extinguish. Darkness has never been able to extinguish the light, and it never will. I don't know about you, I need to hear that, because a lot of times in my life I feel outnumbered by the forces of darkness. It feels like, what possible good can you do being a light? Well, remember that match in the Astrodome. If somebody's looking for light, it doesn't take very much light, no matter how big the darkness. As long as the light's not extinguished, it's anybody looking for light can find it. John does his little rabbit trail here, speaking about John the Baptist. I don't know why he does it in this gospel. Remember, this gospel was written so much later than the others. He wrote it primarily, he right up front, in at the end of this book, he says, look, I didn't write everything that could be written about Jesus. There's not enough paper or ink to do that. I just wrote these things so that you might believe, and so that as you believe in Jesus, you might have life, Zoe, by believing in him. I don't know why he took this little rabbit trail. I doubt that there were any of John the Baptist's disciples left at the time that he wrote this. But it had to be poignant to him that he could have followed the wrong guy for a while. The reason that John and his brother followed John the Baptist, the reason a lot of Jewish people did when John the Baptist came along, is he fit their model of what Messiah was supposed to look like. I don't know if he had muscles. I just don't know. In my mind, John the Baptist was a he-man. I don't know if you saw one, I can't even remember which one of it, but one of the movies that was produced by Hollywood, they cast Michael York in his younger days as John the Baptist. And he was spitting fire, man. And there's one scene where he's baptizing people in this little, tiny little creek, and this big, arrogant Roman riding his big war horse rides in and draws his sword and tells John to stop, that he's going to get arrested. He needs to stop talking about Herod. John's face, it turns red. And he reaches up and he grabs that Roman by his sword belt and he pulls him off of his horse and he starts dunking him in the water. And I just thought, yeah, that's the linebacker, John the Baptist. That's the kind of Messiah Israel was looking for. Jesus did not fit that mold. the reason that John the Baptist did fit the mold was because what they were primarily looking for was somebody who would improve their circumstances. They hated that they were an occupied country. They were just looking for somebody to make their lives more comfortable. John the Baptist looked like the guy, if he could get a good enough army behind him, he looked like the guy that could do it, and he was fearless. You remember in the end of John the Baptist's life, right before he was murdered for telling the truth, it doesn't sound so far-fetched anymore, does it, that you could get arrested for telling the truth if the powers that be don't like the truth? Man, I was just reading about that Marine that was reprimanded and facing a court-martial simply because he criticized the president. And he said, you know, hello, Constitution, freedom of speech, does that not apply? So John the Baptist told the truth, got thrown in jail. He's sitting here in jail and he's thinking, this is after he's already seen Jesus come and the Holy Spirit descending on Jesus and God speaking in a loud voice everybody could hear saying, hey, this is my son. You need to listen to what he has to say. So John knows who Jesus is. John knows he's not the Messiah. But Jesus' style is nothing like his. And now he gets thrown in jail and he's sitting in jail and he's thinking, was I wrong? He's not kicking any Roman heinies, you know. He's hanging out with the wrong people. He can't possibly be a holy man. Sinners like him. All the religious people hate his guts. He seems to be impressing the wrong people to effect change. And John sent his disciples, the few that he had, to Jesus' disciples, sort of a chicken thing to do in a way. But he was in prison, remember? And he said, look, I just need you to tell me one thing. I'm probably going to die here. So I just want to know, did I waste my time? Are you the one? Do I need to be looking for somebody else? And Jesus quoted the Old Testament scripture that talked about Messiah's ministry. And he said, you guys go back and you tell him what you have seen happening. And John will realize I'm doing what Messiah was sent to do. Differences in style hang people up. They still do. It's odd how people have always tried to, like that email you sent me, Mike, people have always tried to create a Jesus that appeals to them. The great danger of that is that you can miss the real Jesus. The Bible gives us so much information. Of course, then when you meet him personally, that just settles things. The one thing about Jesus, you got to say, he does not let you be neutral. He says such outlandish things that you're forced to make a decision. Either this guy's a lunatic, or he's hopelessly deluded, or he's supremely arrogant, or maybe he's telling the truth. John spends more time talking about what Jesus said about who he was than he does spend talking about what other people say about Jesus. That's one of the reasons I love John's gospel. So speaking of John the Baptist, there came a man who was sent from God, no mistake about it. His name was John the Baptist. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light, though that through him all men might believe. He himself was not the light. He just came as a witness to the light. There was a time when John spoke to his, as I said earlier, John spoke to his disciples and he said, you know, I have to decrease. He needs to increase. You need to start following him. He's your bridegroom. As the bride of Christ, he's the one you're getting married to. I'm just the guy that holds the rings, that, you know, passes out the boutonnieres. I'm just the friend. I'm the guy that gives the toast at the reception. I am of lesser importance than him. Verse 9 says, the true light coming into the world. The true light was coming, meaning coming later. I wanted to say one thing about that, and it has to do with the word true. It's a specific Greek word. I'm sorry, I didn't write it down. Fred, do you know what it is? Aletheos, yeah. Aletheos, well, it's related to, yeah. Thank you, resident Greek scholar. It's true as it relates to imaginary, not necessarily true as it relates to false. Let's use a couple of different places. In Philippians chapter 4, it says to not worry about anything, to not be anxious for anything, but present, you know, the four P's, remember that whole study. And then it says, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, fill your mind with that stuff. And it starts off the list with true, but it's dealing with true versus imaginary. Real is actually one of the translations of this Greek word. So if you put that in there, verse 9, the real light that gives light to every man was coming after John. And he did come, and John gave testimony. This is him. This is the one that you need to follow. So back to Jesus, verse 10. He, Jesus, was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world didn't recognize him, didn't know him. Interestingly, we still live in a world that was created by him. We still live in a world where he's holding the atoms together of everything, and the world still doesn't recognize him. It always irritates me a little bit. I guess I understand because humans are so foolish. But it irritates me when I see a bunch of guys, especially guys that don't believe the Bible, trying to tell you who Jesus was. It's interesting that some of the people that don't believe Jesus was who he says he was still believe that he was a real person, that he's not a myth. That's why every time I see the bumper sticker that says Jesus was a myth, I thought, man, you haven't done very good research. There's plenty of historical evidence that Jesus lives. I heard somebody teaching about it on NPR, of all places. Interestingly, they left out a lot of the stuff that Jesus said about himself, but the one conclusion they came to is the one thing you have to say, there was a real guy named Jesus. He's not a myth. I was pondering this. Next week, when we get to the Christmas story, which is four words in John's gospel. By the time John wrote this gospel, all the other three gospels were written. Everybody knew about the wise men and the shepherds and the Hark the Herald Angels Sing and all that stuff. So John just didn't even bother. Decades later, the whole Christmas story is the Word became flesh. Shall we all stand? Kind of thing, you know. End of Christmas pageant. But I found this amazing when it says that he came to the world, he was in the world, and though he made it, and if you believe Colossians, he's holding it all together, didn't recognize him. He submitted himself to a trip down the birth canal of an unmarried Jewish teenager. He submitted himself to life in a nothing of a town, in a blue-collar family. He submitted himself to the religious leaders of his day who should have known better, who had all the evidence as to who he was. He allowed them to insult him and spit on him. He put up with all that. But I think one of the most astonishing things is when he took on human flesh, and we'll talk about this a little bit next week, it says, though the world was made by him, the world didn't. He was in the world and the world didn't recognize him. So he's breathing air that he invented, with lungs that he invented, eating food that he invented, limiting himself to just what all of the things that our human bodies need when he not only made it all. In Philippians itself, it says he was self-limited to the limitations of a human.